Now we're holding on page 64 in Shabbos, about the middle of the wide lines. We're in the middle of talking about various practices, various kinds of superstitions, which the Gemara says are Darchei HaEmodi, the ways of the Goyim, in particular of the Emodim who lived in Eretz Yisrael, and a Yid is not allowed to have anything to do with them. And then the Gemara has given so far a whole list of them. Although with that said, there are Rishonim, actually, we have the Girsa, that the things that the Gemara is mentioning over here, on the contrary, that the Gemara is saying there's not Darchei HaEmodi in them, and therefore that some of them, and then therefore that they would in fact be mutter. We talked about yesterday, for example, the Gemara mentions about shechting a rooster that crows like a hen, or a rooster that crows like a raven, or that crows in the evening, not at the normal time, or a hen that crows like a rooster, where the Gemara says that would be Darchei HaEmodi. On the other hand, Savas or Yehuda HaFasid says you should shecht such a bird, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch. So how do you reconcile that? So we talked about yesterday, one idea is that it depends whether you're actually saying you're doing it because of that, or whether you're just doing it stam. But another point that some Achronim point out is there is a Girsa that some Rishonim have in our Gemara that says that these things are not Darchei HaEmodi, and therefore that would also justify what Rabbi Yehuda HaFasid is saying. Anyway, the Gemara continues. The person says, I'm going to drink from this cup, and I'm going to leave some of the cup over, some of the drink in the cup over. Then also, then that's also a problem of Darchei HaEmodi, because that's a superstitious kind of thing to do. Again, it's also one of those things where either maybe it's not Darchei HaEmodi according to another Girsa, or also maybe if you don't say explicitly, then it would be fine. And in fact, it does mention in the Zohar the idea of leaving over a little bit of liquid in the cup. Another one, Hamavakas Beitzim Bakoisel, when a woman breaks eggs. Again, it doesn't have to mean a woman, but typically women are the ones who deal with these things. So so she breaks eggs against the wall, v'hatoch b'fnei afreichim, or smears them on the wall, both of them in the presence of chicks. So as it's supposed to be some kind of magical or superstitious thing to prevent the chicks from dying, yesh b'midarchei HaEmodi, then it's a problem of darchei HaEmodi. Rashi brings another girsa, not mevakas, that she breaks the eggs against the wall, but mekabas, that she takes the shells after the chicks have come out of the shells. She takes those shells and nails them up or attaches them up to the wall, mekabas, meloshen kova, to fix it in place as a nichush, as a superstition that the chicks shouldn't die. Then that would be darchei HaEmodi. Also, v'amegis b'fnei afreichim. Also, a person who stirs a pot in front of chicks, I guess the same idea, to keep them from dying. Also, yesh b'mishum darchei HaEmodi, that's also a problem of mishum darchei HaEmodi, that too. Hamerakedes, also, there's other things that people would do. I guess it was a big thing that a person's baby chicks might die, so they would do all kinds of superstitious things to prevent it. So Hamerakedes, a woman who dances, or it can also mean who sifts, or she counts out 71 in front of the chicks, so that the chicks don't die. Also, that's also a problem of Darchei HaEmodi, because again, those are superstitious things that a Yid should have nothing to do with. One of the Mefoshim on the Tesefter, we mentioned yesterday that a lot of these things that the Gemara is bringing over here come from two Prok in the Tesefter of Masech the Shabbos that deal with various things of Darchei HaEmodi. One of the Mefoshim there says an interesting point. Why Dafka? Where'd they ever come up with the idea of 71 having to do with this anyway? And he says, because we find you have 70 parim that are brought during Sukkot, and the number decreases from day to day, 13 the first day, 12 the second day, etc. So like, so to speak, any number up to 70 involves decreasing. 71 is the lowest number where you don't have that. Therefore, they came up with this notion of Dafka counting to 71. The Pashtus, because the Gemara is for the most part quoting from that Tosefta, and the Tosefta has them as separate halachas. If you had a really long list like that, then by the end of it, you'd forget whether you'd forget what you're talking about. The Pashtus. So like this, you have as a handy thing that each of these individual things you should know. Yesh b'mishum darchei HaEmodi. Another one, Hamrakedas Lekutach, when a woman dances when she's making kutach. Kutach is a dip that's mentioned in various places in Shas. It was basically made out of sour milk and breadcrumbs and salt. So it was kind of like sour cream or feta cheese or something like that. Anyway, there was a notion that when you're making that, you should dance and that'll make it come out better. Or on the contrary, when a woman is cooking lentils and she tells everybody to be quiet, and there was an idea that that would make them cook better. Or when she's making split peas, on the contrary, she yells out and she tells other people to. Also, all of those are Dauke Hermody. Here you have three of them grouped together, pashtos, because they all have to do with food preparation. Grisin are split peas. So there's a difference between lentils, where they had the notion that being quiet is good for them, versus split peas, where there was the idea that we do fine to a certain extent. We say every day in davening, that speaking is good when you're grinding spices. And Gemara mentions in that context that the reverse is true when you're drawing wine out of a barrel, then it's better to be quiet. The Gemara, in fact, mentions that when the Bismikdash would be buying wine from a vendor, when the Gizbar noticed that dregs are starting to come out with the wine, instead of saying anything, he would tap with a stick to motion to the guy to stop pouring. So there is that concept that sometimes certain kinds of foods, that speech or the lack of it, is good for them. But these particular ones that it's saying over here, at least according to the Girsa that we have, are Dachahem. Another one, Hamashtenes Bifnake Deirosa Kadesh Dispashal Mahera, a woman who urinates in front of her pot of food so that it should cook quickly. Also, Yeshma Mishum Darche Amori, that's also Darche Amori, because obviously there's no logical connection between doing that and the food cooking faster. Toner Abanon, Aval, however, on the other hand, if you want to speed up the cooking, using ways that don't seem to be so obviously, that don't seem to have an obvious cause and effect, but nevertheless they do, and therefore they are mutter, noisnim kesim shel tus, you're allowed to put a piece of mulberry wood into the pot of shivrei zchuchis, or pieces of broken glass, bikdeira, into the pot of food, kadesh dispashal mehera, so it cooks quickly. Those actually have an actual cause and effect. It's not just a nichush. In the case of the mulberry wood, it actually explains it's very sharp, like vinegar, so therefore it makes the food cook faster. He doesn't say what the glass is, but maybe it absorbs some of the heat or something, or spreads out some of the heat. But the Chum say that's true as far as the glass, it's not Dr. Hamuri, but there's a different problem. Because of the danger, a person might end up swallowing a shard of glass. Then we learn in a braisa. Here is another thing that you're allowed to do, even though it, on the face of it, it seems like dauke hamodi, but it's not, because there is an actual logical basis to it. Noisten bul shel melach l'seichaner, you're allowed to put a chunk of salt into a lamp, into an oil lamp, so that it burns more cleanly. And the idea is, it's not nifush, it actually helps, it actually explains, the logic is, the salt actually has an effect on the oil, clarifies the oil, and therefore the oil gets drawn into the wick better, and therefore it's mutter.
What's nifush, magic?
Nifush is a superstition. So not so much magic, but superstition.
Hocus pocus.
Yeah. There is the actual braisa that this comes from actually mentions it in a different context, and this is how it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, is that you're allowed to do that before Shabbos. And there's no concern that maybe you're causing extra burning on Shabbos, and maybe I guess the salt itself may catch on fire or something. There's no problem with it, because on the contrary, it makes the oil flow better, and that way you have a nicer Shabbos lamb. Venoisten tit v'chausis tachas aner. Similarly, you're allowed to put clay or crushed brick, or chausis can be crushed brick or crushed earthenware, under the lamp, Bishvosha Tamtin Vitadlik, so that it cools off and it'll burn better. The idea being those things absorb heat, and therefore that cools off the oil, and therefore it doesn't evaporate and burn as fast. So those are not Dauche Hamuri, because those have an actual logical basis to them. Omer Mazutra, so Mazutra mentions in this connection, not directly in connection with Dauche HaModi, but since we're mentioning things that when it comes to lighting lamps to make them burn longer or whatever, so the flip side is also true. Haiman de Machasi Shraga de Mishcha, if a person covers up an oil lamp where there that causes the oil to burn faster, or Megali Nefta, or he has a lamp that's lit with Neft, which is in English, it's called naphtha. It's similar to turpentine or kerosene or other such things. That kind of thing. Rashi points out earlier in the Masechta, it mentions that stuff is very volatile. It catches on fire very easily. So what happens is, if you keep the lamp, if you keep the reservoir of neft uncovered, what happens is the fire ends up jumping to that as well. It doesn't just burn on the wick. It also ends up burning inside the actual reservoir of neft. So then, so a person does that. He's over on either of those things. He's over on Baal Tashchis because he's causing the oil to get used up faster and therefore wasting it. Okay. One more thing about Darche HaModi, or the lack of it. To say the following toast, the following thing, as l'chaim, Tamra v'chayim, wine and life, l'fum rabbanon, to the mouths of the chachamim, ein b'mishim darche emori, that's not darche emori, that's you saying it as a broch. And in fact, Maisa b'Rabbi Akiva, sha'asa mishta l'bnoi, it happened that Rabbi Akiva once made a wedding for his son, v'al kol kos v'kos shehevi, and every cup that he was bringing to serve to the chachamim, omra, he was saying the following toast, chamra v'chayim pum rabbanon, wine and life to the mouths of the chachamim, chayim v'chamra l'pum rabbanon, l'pum tamidehon, life and wine for the mouths of the chachamim and the mouths of their tamidim. Now, why in the first one is he not mentioning Talmidim, and why in the second one is he reversing the order, putting the Chaye before Chamra? So Maharsha brings like this. There's a Gemara in Baba Basra that tells how the Romans, it says, had written on one of their city gates, they had it written in their I forget where it was exactly, maybe if it was on their city gates or whatever, in their writings or whatever. The head of everything that brings life is wine. Actually, Gemara goes on to say there that Rabbana met up with them and said that's not really correct. And the right way you should say it is that wine is the chief medicine. But the original version was wine is the chief thing for life. So now, when is that? Maharsha says only if you drink it in the proper amount, not if a person drinks it too much. So therefore, Rabbi Akiva is first saying to the Chachamim, before he speaks to the Talmidim, he's saying, Chamra b'chaye, wine and life. If you drink according to the right amount, then that'll bring you life. And he's telling them, even if you do end up drinking a little bit extra, you should still have chayim. Hashem should still bench you with life, and you shouldn't have the bad consequences of it. Then he continues chayim v'chamra. He's saying that they should continue to be chayim v'chayomim. They should continue to be living and healthy as before they drank the wine. So he mentioned the talmidim because talmidim often tend to overindulge. Because they're not yet old enough to realize that they should hold themselves back. There's a reason why, for example, one of the reasons why, you know, there's a famous thing they've ever made about the four kelishklach only up to age 40, because by the time a person is 40, you would expect that he knows how to control himself anyway. So that would be why the first time he doesn't mention the Talmideha, and only the second time, because the second time he's mentioning to them first that they need to have the chayim before the wine, that they should be careful, the Talmidim in particular have to be careful not to overindulge. A couple of other mefoshim, Ben Yehoyada and Pesher Agadta talk about various other ideas about it, that it's more along the lines of that we find it, we know Nichnas Yayin Yotza Soid, but the Talmudim have to be careful not to speak up in the presence of the Rebbeim without being given permission. Therefore, he mentions the wine and then the life first for the Rabbanan. Meanwhile, for the Talmudim, he starts with the life first and only then the wine. Others be careful about the wine because then it's going to lead you to speak in front of your Rebbeim in a way that you shouldn't be doing. Klau Godor Perek Shvi. The Perek begins by talking about the dinim of under what circumstances, if a person breaks Shabbos, under what circumstances he bring only one chatas for all of the Shabbos that he broke, versus one chatas separately for each Shabbos, versus one chatas separately for each malacha. And then after that, the next Mishnah goes on and lists the 39 of us malachas, and then the rest of the Perek starts listing details about basic concepts about the malachas and things a person carries out a certain thing on Shabbos, what's the minimum to be chayim. So in the course of discussing, so the Gemara discusses the point that you could have a person who never knew about Shabbos in the first place, a tinik shenishba. So in that connection, the Gemara brings a related idea where a person doesn't know that it's Shabbos because he lost track of the days. So Omer Avona, Hoy Mahalach Baderech Oy Bamidbar, if a person is traveling on the road or in the desert, the Eni Yadea Emasai Shabbos, he doesn't know when Shabbos is, Mona Shisha Yom Mashama Yom Echad. What he has to do is he has to count 6 days from when he realized that he lost track. So the day that he realizes that becomes in effect his Sunday, and the next day becomes his Monday and so forth, or Mashama Yom Echad, and then he keeps the seventh day as Shabbos. There's a few places in Sichus where the Rebbe brings an interesting point that Advaz says that that for such a person, that day that he that day that he keeps his Shabbos actually becomes Shabbos Daraisa for him. The Gemara goes on to mention details about it that are not here in Ein Yaakov. For example, each day he can only do malacha only enough to live for that day. Because what if today is in fact what if today is Shabbos and the next day is not, and then he's doing malacha unnecessarily on Shabbos. But on the other hand, he's allowed to walk as far as he wants or do other things to get himself out of the situation, so he doesn't have to be in the situation forever. So he's allowed to walk even many parsois. And there's a short simon in Shulchan Aruch, simon shin dalad mem in Aruch Chaim, that discusses these dinim. Anyway, Chia bar Rav Omer, Chia bar Rav says the other way. First he should keep the one day Shabbos. And then after that, he counts the next 6 days are the weekdays. So actually, to be exact, Rashi says, according to Chiyah Barab, the day that he realized that he lost track, he may have already done Malacha earlier that day. Therefore, he doesn't make that day his Shabbos. The next day becomes his Shabbos. So the Gemara says, "B'mayik mitzvah." What's the underlying machlokas? Mar sabak b'riyasa shalolam. Rav Huna holds that you go according to the way the world was created. First, there were 6 weekdays, and then there was Shabbos. Therefore, this person should be doing the same kind of thing. Mar sabak Adam Rishon, whereas Chiya bar Rav holds you should follow the example of Adam Rishon. He was created on Friday and then went straight into Shabbos. So even though he was created on Friday, but that day itself already he was created late enough in the day that it already had a connection to Shabbos. There is an interesting thing. There's a famous long story that the Friedrich Rebbe wrote in a letter to our Rebbe and to the Rebbetzin, telling a whole long arichos about a couple of old friends who eventually all became chassidim of the Baal Shem Tov. It's a very, very long story. Currently, I think parts of it are being serialized in the weekly Chayenus. Anyway. So in the course of that, he mentions over there that one of these friends, Reb Mordechai, mentions over there a Torah that he heard from the Baal Shem Tov on this Gemara over here about Avodas HaTorah versus Avodas HaTfilah. So a person is lost in the weekdays are connected more with Avodas HaTorah. Shabbos is connected more with Avodas HaTfilah. So when a person realizes that he's lost track, and he doesn't know his way to Avodas HaTfilah, so the proper way, so you have the Machlokas. Rav Huna is saying, first he has to have the 6 days of, of Avodah, and then he'll be able to come to Avodas HaTfilah properly, whereas Chiya bar Rav is saying the other way around. Chiya represents where a person has chayus in learning, so therefore he already has that, so therefore he can right away start with the Shabbos, and only then go on to the rest of the weekday Avodah. Further on in the parak, again, it lists the 39 Avos Malachas, and the Gemara starts going through details of some of them. So one of them is the Malacha of Borer, and the Gemara deals with the details of what exactly is and isn't considered Borer. So the Gemara mentions in this connection, Ki Osir of Dimi Omer, when Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael, he told over that one time in Eretz Yisrael, Shabbos of Rav Bibi Havoi, one time it was the Shabbos of Rav Bibi, which Rashi says means it was his turn to be serving the Talmidim. By the way, we mentioned before, the Shalach HaKadosh says the name is not supposed to be pronounced Bibi, he says it's supposed to be pronounced Bevi, which is a name that we find in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah. Anyway. It was his turn to serve the food. The Iklu, Rab Ami, Rab Asi. Rab Ami and Rab Asi were present over there when he was serving the food. Shodder Kamayo Kalkola de Peri, he poured out in front of them a basket of fruit with, you have the fruit mixed in with the leaves. Now, Veloya Dina, sort of Dimi says, I don't know why he did it that way. Is it that he holds that picking out the food from among the waste would be osir, and therefore he couldn't pick out the fruit and serve them only the fruit and leave the leaves behind in the basket? Which Tosfos actually points out that would mean if he's doing it for la'achar zman, if you're doing it right away to eat it right away on the spot, then everybody agrees it's mutter. There'd be no question that Rabbi wasn't concerned about that. But what we're talking about is it also to do it for later, where in fact the halacha is that it is. Or is it just because he wanted to serve them generously? He wanted to have a big pile in front of them, so it should look like a generous amount is being served.
I didn't get it. He's picking out the fruit from the other stuff. The fruit is the ochel, and the other stuff is the
perspective. That's the point. Is it that he holds that oichel material services? You are allowed to do that, but only if you're doing it to eat right away, not if you're doing it for later on. So that's Tosfos points out that when Reb Dimi is saying, I'm not sure what Reb Bivi held, it must be, since everybody agrees that it's mutter, if you're doing it for right away, when you're taking oichel matzah psolos, then it must be that he's saying like this, he's putting it on the table, but they're not necessarily going to be eating it right away. And therefore the question is, did he in fact hold that it's also where in fact the halacha is, it is also. Then Yehoyada has a bit of a different explanation of the story. He says it doesn't mean that it was Reb Bivi was serving the Talmidim. It means that he was hosting them for a Kiddush or a Shabbos meal or something. Further on, among the Malachas, among the 39 Malachas are tying and untying, Hakoshav Amater. So they're going to ask, Shidab Mishkan Hechavoy, where do you have tying in the Mishkan? Amar Rabba Shekin Koshim Bi Sedis Olim. So Rava says that when they had the Mishkan had pegs, the Yistos of Mishkan that I mentioned a few places in the Pesukim. So you had pegs that were attached to the edges of the curtains and also to the poles themselves that would stick them. Rashi mentions at the end of Parashat Truma, he says, I'm not sure based on the description in the Pesukim whether it means that they actually stuck them into the ground or whether it just means that they were heavy and they held things down with their weight. He says, since they're called Yistos, which means pegs, Mastama, they were stuck into the ground. Anyway, the point is they had ropes tied to them, where the idea is that those pegs help keep everything in place, help keep the curtains from flapping around or whatever.
Yeah.
So Rava says, and that's the point, is they would tie ropes to the pegs when they're setting up the Mishkan. Amalei Abaye, but Abaye says Koshrim. How can he call that tying of a kind that should be Osir Midaraisa on Shabbos? How Keshra Manas Lahatu? That's the kind of tying which eventually is going to be meant to be untied. Midaraisa, the kind of knot that's also on Shabbos, is only when it's a professional knot and one that's never meant to be untied. If you eventually mean to untie it, then it's also only Dirabam. And if we learn all the malachas from the Mishkan, then it has to be. We have to find some way where you tie something permanently. The Yerushalmi actually deals with that. The Rebbe mentions this briefly in a sicha, and mentions the Yerushalmi actually takes the view that it doesn't matter. Anytime they set up the Mishkan, even though it may only be for overnight, as we know from the Pesukim and Parshas Baal Oyska, it could conceivably happen that they come to a place and then the next morning the Onon is already leaving and it's time for them to go. Nevertheless, any place where they camp is considered, because it's Al Pi Hashem Yachnu, Al Pi Hashem Yiso, any place that they are is considered like it's permanent. So, and therefore that would be, however, the Bavli over here, Abaya, is obviously not liking that answer. So Ella Amar Abaya, Shekain Urga Yurias Shenifsa Klahem Nimra, because what happens is when they're weaving the curtains, if a thread breaks, Koshrinosa, then they would tie the broken ends together. You have to consider how a loom is set up to weave. You have the chassis threads that are passed through two frames with loops in them to be able to raise and lower the even numbered ones and then the odd numbered ones and be able to weave back and forth. So if one of those chassis threads tears, then you don't want to have to take it out and replace it with a whole new one, especially if you've already started weaving the cloth. So you would tie the two broken ends together. So Amalei Rava Tiratzta Kosher. So Rava said, okay, well, that explains the tying. Matu Ma'ikla Memer, where would you ever have in a scenario like that where you're untying? V'chi Tema, so you might answer, Di Misrami Le Tre Chutri Kishri Bahadi Adodi. What if it happens that you happen to have two threads like that, one next to the other, two chassis threads that broke like that, and you're going to tie both of them, and you're going to say that's no good because then it sticks out of the cloth too much. So therefore, Shari Chad the Kotir Chad. Therefore, you're going to untie one and leave the other one tied. That's how Rashi learns. Tosfos actually a couple of blocks earlier argues with that, because the word koter chad implies that you're actually tying something, not just that you're leaving it tied. So Tosfos has a bit of a different explanation. You could have a scenario, let's say, where a thread broke in two places, and you would tie, and then at first you're putting in another piece to make up for the missing piece. So you tie it at both ends, but then later on you'd untie one of them and tie the other and do it that way. The problem with that is Hashkalaf named Malach Basav Adam in Osim Kane. You wouldn't even do that in front of a human king, because when you untie that thread, so if you have like that, let's say like Rashi, that you have two threads next to one another that had to be knotted. The problem is that the threads for the Urias were very thick. We know that they were six ply threads. Actually, there were six plies each of Tchelas, Agroman, Telastrani, and Sheish. Altogether, the entire thread was 24 ply. So that makes a very thick thread. And that means that if you have a place like that where you had there was going to be a knot and then you untie it, then you're going to have a big hole over there. So even in front of a bus of a dumb, if you're making curtains for him, you wouldn't make them like that because it wouldn't look good. Would you do that in front of Hashem? No, if you have something like that, if you have a problem like that, two threads, one next to the other that broke, what you would do is you would never to begin with have two of them knotted next to the other, one next to the other. What you do is one of them would be knotted over here and the other one, you would cut off the thread in other places and knot in and tie in a replacement thread in other places so that you never have in the first place two knots like that, one next to the other. So the point is, in other words, you don't really have untying over there because you're not untying. You would cut away that area and you'd knot in a new thread. So that doesn't work there. Where do you have matir? The people who are trapping the chilozim, they use nets for it. So nets involve a lot of knots all over the place. Sometimes you'd need to take a piece of a net off of a piece of netting off of one and put it on and attach it to another one to fill in a hole where it ripped or whatever it is exactly. So therefore you do have tying and untying, and each time when they're tying it or when they're untying it, it's meant to stay permanently that way. And therefore that would be the malacha daraisa of kosher and matir. At the bottom of the page says that it also represents how closely the Shechina and the Jewish people are connected. So therefore, this whole thing about kosher and matir also symbolizes how careful we have to keep, and how careful we have to make sure to act in a way that will keep that connection a permanent one. Further on, again, the Gemara goes on to talk about various other malachas, one of them being the malacha of sewing. So Omer of Zutra Baturvia Omerab, Hamaseach Chut Shal Tfira B'Shabbos, if a person stretches out the sewing thread on Shabbos, Chayev Chatas, then it would be Chayev Chatas for that, because that's a malacha. What are we talking about? So Rashi says we're talking about, you have a garment has already been sewn together, but over time the stitches have come loose. So now the different parts of cloth that make up the garment have now separated. So what do? You pull on that thread in order to tighten them up and then bring them back together. So that's part of the malacha of sewing. So therefore, a person would be chayev for that. The Rambam has a different understanding of it. He says we're talking about, to begin with, when a person is starting to sew and he stretches out the thread so that it'll go smoothly into the fabric, then that's part of the malacha of sewing. Anyway, Rav Zutra Bar Turvia also says, by the way, two other things that are not directly related to that. Rashi explains he learned them all three together from Rav, and therefore he learned them and therefore he repeated them all together, even though they don't directly have one to do with the other. So the second thing he says is, if a person learns even one single thing from an ambush, which the Gemara is going to describe in a couple of lines what it is, so a person is chayev misa for learning from such a person. And the third one is, if a person knows how to calculate tkufas mazolus, he knows how to calculate the seasons and when each mazol is visible and so forth, which Rashi explains further on, among other things, you can use that to help forecast what the weather is going to be. So a person knows how to do that and doesn't do it. Also, the saper hemenu, you're not allowed to talk with such a person because he's by doing that, by not engaging in that kind of calculations, he's taking away some of the glory of Hashem. Like this, a person could use that knowledge to as the Gemara is going to say soon, to make that even the goyim will respect the yidin. It also means the person himself will realize how exquisitely everything is put together by Hashem, and then come to greater Ava and Yira of Hashem. That Rama makes a similar point in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, that he describes that a person learns about these kinds of things, about Maisa Merkava and Maisa Bereshis. It brings him to an Ava and a Yira of Eivishter. So therefore, a person doesn't do it, then you're not supposed. You shouldn't. Don't talk with such a person. So. What is the definition of Megushta or Amgusha? We said a person learns something from an Amgush, he's Chayet Nisa. Tosfos brings that also. So Rashi says it's actually not just in reference to this one statement that we said. Rashi says in general, in a number of places in Shas, we have mention of somebody called a character called an Amgusha. What exactly are they, and what is wrong with them? Tosfos brings from the Oruch a different explanation. Specifically, the Gemara tells us in Moed Katan that Paroi from Moshe Rabbeinu's times was an Amgushi. And it says he would go out to the river. And therefore, Hashem tells Moshe, go meet him over there and tell him about Makas Dam and so forth. So then the question would be, what was the big problem with him? What was he going to the river for? What did he hope to accomplish? So Rab and Shmuel argued. One of them says that an Amgushi is a person who practices magic. And the other one says Gedufi is somebody who blasphemes and then speaks disrespectfully about Hashem. So Rashi describes he's very fanatical about his avodah zarah, and he's always blaspheming and talking chutzpah against Hashem and trying to convince people to join his religion and join his avodah zarah. So then the second opinion is saying that's what an Amgusha is. Historically, you have the Persian Galochim were called, and in the Persian language, they were called Magus. Yeah, that word in English also. Eventually, the word magic also comes from it in English. And Amgusha is a variant of that word. You can find something about it actually in this week's Chayenu, in the article of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak's Torah. There's actually something over there that also talks about an Amgusha after whom a chamber in the Bais Hamikdash was named. Anyway, an Amgusha, so we're saying one of these Persian Galochim, or one of these Amgushas that we're mentioning in various places in Shas, is the primary problem with him that he does black magic, or is the primary problem with him that he blasphemes Hashem and tries to convince people to avodah zarah? Now, so we said Rab and Shmuel, one of them says this, one of them says that. Which one said which? Tistayim, we can conclude that Rav Omer Gedufi, that Rav is the one who says that the problem with the Amgusha is that he blasphemes Hashem. The Omer Rav Zutra Batrovia, Omer Rav, because we just said that Rav Zutra Batrovia said in Rav's name, Aloy Medavach from an Amgush, Chayiv Misa, that you learn, even the person learns even one thing from an Amgush, is Chayiv Misa. So now you have to realize the Sakurat Achaushi, if you're going to say the only problem with the Amgush is that he's a magician, then what's the problem? V'oksiv lo suman lasis, the pasuk says you're not allowed to learn magic in order to actually practice it. Avot to lomid lahovin lahodis, but you are allowed to learn it in order to understand how it works, or in order to teach others. So, for example, Rashi says a Navi Sheker comes and does something, you'll be able to realize that it was done by black magic. Or to teach others what's osur and what's mutter, as we find examples in Gemara Sanhedrin, where Rabbi Eliezer and other Chachamim taught their Talmudim such things. So therefore, if the problem with an Amgusha was only that he was a magician, there wouldn't be in and of itself a problem in learning from him, because you could learn from him the magic, not in order to practice it, but in order to lahovin lahoris. So therefore, Tisayim, that shows, therefore, that Rav is saying the problem with the Amgusha is not just that he's a magician, but that he blasphemes Hashem. You want to stay far away from such a person. Anything he says, Rashi says, is going to be minus, and you want to stay away from him so he doesn't start having an effect on you. So Tosfos again mentions, according to the Oruch's explanation, the question is, what was Pare doing by the river? Was he trying to do kishuf, or was he blaspheming Hashem and saying, as the famous expression in the pasuk, Yo'ur Livani Asisini, the river is mine, and I made myself, and I made the river, etc. We mentioned about this point, a person who knows how to calculate Kufus and Mazolus and doesn't. So more on that topic. Amr b'shim ben Pazi, Amr b'shim ben Levi, Mishum bar Kabara. Kola yadei l'chashev but Kufus and Mazolus. V'ene choshev, a person who knows how to calculate Kufus and Mazolus, but he doesn't do that. And that way, for example, as Rashi points out further on, and Marsha points out over here, it means therefore that he fails to know and to inform people when it's going to be rainy, when it's going to be hot, etc. So then, so all of our Kosev Omer, the Pasuk says on him, a criticism that the Espoil Hashem lo yabitu, they're not looking at the works of Hashem, or Maisa Yad of Lo, and they're not seeing the things that Hashem made. So in other words, the idea is when a person knows how to calculate these things, then, like this, you can have, Marsha explains, there's what a person sees with his eyes, and there's also what a person calculates, whether a person calculates with his brain. So now this person is lacking in both of those. But there's the idea also again that it means that he's not looking at the great works of Hashem, and instead he's pretending as though they're unimportant. Amr of Shmuel ben Achmeni, Amr of Yonason, minayin shem mitzvah al adam v'chashav tkufas mazolis. How do we know that there is in fact a mitzvah on a person if he's able to calculate tkufas mazolis? Shenema, the pasuk says, shmartim v'asisem. You should guard the Torah and you should do it. Kihi choch maskam v'naskam la'enei amim, because it is your wisdom and your understanding in the eyes of the nations. So ezuhi choch mobinishi la'enei amim. What kind of understanding of these things would be noticeable in the presence of the goyim? Because after all, the Chochmah of Torah, they're not familiar with, Hebeyem is a Chishuv Tkufas Mazolis, that would be calculating these kinds of things. Because again, Rashi says this way, for example, you're able to say this year will be rainy or this year will be sunny or whatever, and it comes true, and therefore that makes people realize that we Jews know what we're talking about. That's why we say that's La'enei Ha'amim. With that said, you know, I mean, all of this is not meant to be at the expense of regular learning Torah. You know, Yad Altadev mentions in Perek Ches of Tanya the idea that learning Chochmas Chatzonius can be very dangerous unless a person knows, like the Rambam and the Ramban, how to use them properly. There's in fact actually a letter from the Rebbe in the back of one of the Chalokim of the Likutei Sichos, I don't remember now which one, where he goes through like there are six different ways in which a person could be using Chochmas Chatzonius in an appropriate way. You have to, you know, Parshat, for example, a person needs it to make a living, or you have, for example, that he uses it you could have, he doesn't even learn from Goyish books themselves, he derives them all from within the Torah. Like we have, for example, the famous story where Rabbi Yeshua derives from Psukim how long a snake is pregnant, and other such things like that. And you have various other kinds of examples like that. And then you have the example where a person does actually go and delve into the Goyish books on the subject, but he's doing it because he knows he has the ability to use that for Kedusha. And the Altar brings over there in Tanya, for example, the Rambam and the Ramban who did just that.
Snake is 7 years before it gives birth.
Yeah, that's the Rabbi Yeshua says that over there. Yeah. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach Ogoma, Dalad here. La'asid Lavoi, in Eretz Yisrael, there will be Jews from all the generations, including the 10 lost Shvatim. So that I've talked about, even after the land of Eretz Yisrael was conquered in Yeshua's times, you didn't always have a time of Kol Yeshvei Olam. You had a certain amount of time in history when there was that all Jews are living in Eretz Yisrael, but not always. Eventually Shvatim went into Golos and that stopped, etc. La'asid Lava, though, it will be Kol Yeshvei Olam. Because first of all, you'll have the Aseret HaShvatim who were taken into Golus beyond Nahar Sambatian. They're going to come back, as in fact we find Psukim in Yechezkel and in various other places that demonstrate that they're going to be members of all 12 Shvatim there. Besides that, also there's going to be Bnei Yisrael from all the generations. So you'll have the Kol Yeshvel. You'll also have the complete Aleha, because you're going to have the whole 10 lands or the lands of all the 10 nations, including the Keni, Knizi, and Kadmoni. So then you'll have much more of a Kol Yeshvel Aleha, literally Kol, than you ever had before. Continuing on halachas of Shech Yonu and Atov V'Ametiv and the related brachas, if a person's father or some other relative passes away, or even not a relative, but it's an Odom Kosher, or the Alter Rebbe phrases it differently, somebody where you feel tsar because you love him and now he passed away, or all the more so if he's a Talmud Chacham, then you say the Baruch HaDayanemus. For any other person where you don't feel so bad, then you say also say Dayanemus, but without shame and malchus. If the father left him an estate to inherit, then also after saying Baruch HaDayanemus with shame and malchus, he also says Shech Yonu. And if he has brothers as well who are going to be inheriting together with him, then instead it's Hatov V'Ametiv, because the usual rule when you have something that benefits yourself and somebody else, that it's Hatov V'Ametiv. Another din, when a person builds a house or buys important kalim or important clothing, even if he had similar to them before, but these particular ones never belonged to him, and he's happy with them, then he says Shech Yonu. The Alter Rebbe actually says that for other kinds of clay tashmish, even gold and silver, the minhag is not to make the bracha at all, only on clothing. So you make the bracha when you buy them or when you finish building, even though you haven't used them yet. What? So clothing you often have. I mean, clothing is much more, is much cheaper and much easier to get nowadays. So I think to the extent people do it for clothing is only for like something really important, like a new suit or something, not just like a new shirt or pair of pants or something. The Alter Rebbe brings, though, let's say you bought a garment and it hasn't been sewn yet and you still have to take it to the tailor to sew, or I guess maybe the same thing would apply, let's say to a suit where you need to get it hemmed. So Yeshayim, you don't make the bracha when you buy it, only after you first wear it. Anyway, the point is the bracha is for the Simchas Halev. You're happy that you bought them. That's why you say it then, rather than waiting until you actually wear them. When you actually put it on, you say the bracha, Malbush Arumim, the Alter Rebbe adds without Shema Malchus. Now,
after you wear it the first time.
After, when you wear it the first time, you say Malbush Arumim. When you bought it, you say Shechiyanu. Now, when you're wearing it the first time, you say Malbush Arumim. But he adds, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch adds, that this is if you made already the bracha Malbush Arumim in the morning in Birkas HaShachar, and now you're putting this one on for the first time later on in the day. If you're putting it on for the first time in the morning, then you can be Yotze with the bracha Malbush Arumim. And in fact, the Alter Rebbe says it's best to do it that way. Yesh Omrim, that when you're buying a hat, then you say Otu Yisrael B'Sifara when you put it on the first time, and a belt Ozi Yisrael B'Gvura. Others disagree. Therefore, the better thing is, again, put them on first thing in the morning and have in mind that to pat to them with those brachas. If you put them on later, then the Alter Rebbe says say it without shame or malchus.
Even though the belt is not so choshev, it's just
a... So again, maybe nowadays that a belt is not so choshev, you can buy them for 10 bucks in the store, is different. One more, if a person buys a talus shal mitzvah, then after he puts the tzitzis on it, then he says shechiyonu. If not, then he says the bracha when he first puts it on. Then he says shechiyonu when he first puts it on after the isat of the tzitzis. Although the Alter Rebbe actually says the order should be the other way around. First, he should say the shechiyonu, then the isat of the tzitzis.